how grateful we are for our children, for they give us hope. They help us recall the past because they demand from us stories about who we are and where we've been. They also give us hope because through them, we see God's work in the world and the grand possibilities of all that lies ahead because of their smiles, their energy, their hope. The color purple is prominent in the season of Advent, as you see from our stoles and other places throughout the coming weeks moving in the direction of Christmas Day. The color purple stands for a number of things in the Christian year. For the Christian life, it is a reminder of, first of all, mystery, of God's presence among us in ways that we cannot fully describe, but we are called still to try to put words to. We are a people of hope by symbolizing that hope through the color purple, also representing a sense of royalty, a connection to something that is vital and vibrant in our life. It is the color of expectancy, of anticipation, of the sense that something good is about to happen. It is good and right then in the season of Advent that the color purple lies in the background and stands for the candles that we light to remind ourselves of hope and peace and joy and love. With this resonating sense of hope, this expectant spirit, the color purple providing for us a kind of background for all that is and is to come. You heard the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke and that beautiful and very traditional, what we call the birth narrative of Jesus. We'll be hearing that over and over again in the coming weeks. It will be repeated finally on Christmas Eve in our service together. But it's the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. Something very important happens in the first chapter of the Gospel of Luke that sets the ground for hope. It sets the stage for the story of Jesus. And it begins in this way, with these very interesting words. In the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly order of Abijah. His wife was a descendant of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. In these brief words that start out the Gospel of Luke, we get connected, first of all, to a historical event. King Herod, also known as Herod the Great, was a historical person, a real guy, and it sets the stage for something that is happening really in real life, in historical time. It sets this story of Jesus in a real place, in a real time, with real people. This is the Bible's way of saying, on September 11th in 2001, everything changed. Most of us know immediately where we were when we hear that time frame. It sets the stage. We know what things were like before. We know what things were like and are like after. Luke says it this way. In the days of King Herod of Judea. That was fresh on everyone's mind. They knew what it was like before. They knew what it was like after. The stage is set, and Zechariah and Elizabeth are clearly set now in a time frame, and now we get the spiritual connection. The coming of Jesus is firmly set against the backdrop of a priest in the temple in Jerusalem. His name is Zechariah, and his wife is Elizabeth. Let's find out what else the Bible has to say to us. Luke continues in sharing that Zechariah, as a priest in the temple, came up to his time when he was supposed to go to the temple and do his duty by walking into the Holy of Holies, lighting the candles, and preparing that special place for the prayers of the people. No one was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies except the priest on a special occasion. It was such a sacred spot. The ground was so holy, there was a concern that when the priest walked in, that the person would be so overwhelmed with the holiness of this sacred space that they would die. And then no one else could go in and get their body because nobody else was allowed in the temple. So they would tie a rope around the ankle of the priest just in case the priest was incapacitated. Nobody would have to go in. They would just drag him out. Now, we know that there are churches that have thought of this for preachers over the years. Some have threatened that. He's preaching a little long. Go ahead and yank that cord. This was the tradition in the temple where the people in this moment are concerned because Zechariah has not come out. He stayed in there way too long, and the people begin to say, should we drag him out? Something has happened. Well, it turns out, according to Luke, an angel spoke to Zechariah in the temple and told him these words, that he and his wife Elizabeth are going to have a son. Now, this was strange to Zechariah because Zechariah was an old man. And his wife, as Luke says so beautifully, is getting on in years. Very diplomatic way of painting this picture of Zechariah and Elizabeth. We have an actual photograph from those days. And you can imagine now these two older people. Now, this should set the stage for many of you, you Bible scholars out there who are familiar with Bible stories from the Old Testament. This should remind you of someone: Abraham and Sarah. You see, Elizabeth was barren. She was unable to bear a child. And so when Zechariah hears these words from the angel, he says to the angel, "This can't be right. You do realize that my wife is barren and we're getting on in years. I'm old and she's getting up in years." The angel is a little perturbed and makes Zechariah unable to speak. The story unfolds and it sets the stage for a very important birth narrative that precedes Jesus' birth story. We'll get to that in a moment, but as a reminder, there's a comparison going on here, not just with the Genesis story. Luke expects us to get the fact that there's a parallel. Amy Jill Levine likes to call this a foundational story. It's a story that recurs at several points in the scriptures. In this case, it is Abraham and Sarah. Sarah was barren. Abraham and Sarah also were getting up in years. They were unable to have children. They were never going to have children, except God says, when you say there's no way, I say there is a way. And so the miracle occurs, and of course, Abraham and Sarah bear a son, and his name is Isaac. In this case, it is, of course, Elizabeth who is barren. It is the fact that Zechariah is incapable of remembering or recognizing the fact that this miracle can occur again, maybe with us. Luke subtly provides another parallel, and this time it's not so much from Genesis, but it's from Judges chapter 13, where we find out there's a woman who goes unnamed. She's simply spoken of as the wife of Manoah. She too is getting on in years. She too is barren. She too has a husband. His name is Manoah. Like Zechariah, Manoah has a little trouble believing the fact that this could actually be so, because an angel comes to both his wife and to him and says, "You're going to bear a son." "How can that be?" he says. "We're old. We can't bear a son. My wife is barren." And the angel says, "It's going to happen." And he says, "Well, listen, give me some identification. Look this up. It's in Judges chapter 13. He says, "Give me some identification. What is your name?" And the angel, this is so cool, the angel goes, "It's none of your business. Just know that the son you're going to have will not be allowed to have strong drink and will never be allowed to cut his hair." Now, some of you are starting to figure this out already, but we also have an actual photograph of Manoah and his wife, the unnamed woman, both barren, getting up in years, struggling with their lives, and having a difficult time figuring out how to digest this new information. Because let's face it, they'd gotten accustomed to living on their own, in their own special time and rhythm. And some of you know how this feels, to be invaded by grandchildren on Thanksgiving. And you love them, and you feel so good waving goodbye as they pull out of the driveway. This is an adjustment. And Manoah and his wife and Elizabeth and Zechariah are taking a while to digest the news. Now, what we have in Luke in this first chapter, of course, Elizabeth and Zechariah, this couple unable to have children, discover that they are going to have the joy of a new son, and his name is going to be John the Baptist. Now, this is also important for us here at First Baptist Decatur, because notice, he's not John the Methodist. He's not John the Presbyterian. He is John, let's say it together, the Baptist. This ought to make us feel a little better about ourselves. John the Baptist. Now, in contrast, Luke is very intentionally paralleling this story with the story in Judges, because exactly the same things happen in Judges 13 through 16, with one exception. The wife of Manoah, like Elizabeth, was barren. Manoah, like Zechariah, was a little clueless and had trouble digesting this news. They both struggled in figuring out how to make this happen. Both of them were told that their children should stay away from strong drink and should be what was ultimately called the Nazarite vow. They're to be in the wilderness on their own, working on behalf of God. Who is the son of Manoah and his wife? Samson. The parallel that Luke seems to be drawing is very important, because everything is the same with one exception. Samson, called to live a life devoted to God, devoted to others, giving of himself. In fact, how did Samson live? You read these three chapters and you realize at every point and in every way, Samson completely looked beyond the calling that God gave to him and centered his life on what and whom? His own pleasure and himself. Everything about Samson is about Samson. In contrast, Luke, I'm sure, is saying to John the Baptist, because like Samson, John the Baptist, called to live his life for others, to prepare the way for something good coming after him, John the Baptist got it right. He laid the foundation for hope, because everything he said and did in his life was not about himself, but about Jesus, the one who is going to come on our behalf. Everything John spoke about and lived had to do with turning, repenting. And this finally is the vital part of hope. The prophets for years spoke about this word, the hope that God is giving, the expectation that something is going to happen, that God is going to overturn everything and make things right. Here's the thing that John the Baptist sets the foundation for with Jesus. We see it in the song of Zechariah. We hear it in the song of Mary. And that is, the prophets are speaking the truth. Leading up to John the Baptist, they are giving hope, not so much about calling on people and predicting the future, but they are calling on people together to change the future. You listen to the prophet's words, and it's not that they're predicting, but they're calling on you and me to stand together, as Shelley said so beautifully in her prayer, that sometimes hope is not just believing what will be, but standing with our own two feet and allowing God to use us to help things come to be. The power of hope, the beauty of purple, and this expectant spirit of what God is doing in the world happens in the birth of Jesus, and ultimately the call of Jesus to you and me to follow, to live, and to make hope real. And so it is not only the color purple, but the evergreen. And this call into this Christmas season of the hope in Jesus that changes everything and connects us to life now and life everlasting. Thanks be to God. Amen.